Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Reminder, we Zoom on Monday afternoon, so if Donald Trump should pull something out of his hat on Monday night, we're not going to be talking about it until the end of the week. Before we introduce our first guest, I remind everyone that we start every single radio show. We've been doing it for months between now and the November election with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I knew I needed to share it. I am really proud I did it. I'm glad we've done it every single day. You will know every single word that he said, especially when he turned and said, "It'll be okay, Dad. It'll be all right." And what we realize now is it wasn't all right for him. It wasn't all right for his twin brother. And frankly, it's not all right for the country or the world. We need to make change in November of 2020. Now, a patriot, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
So I used to hang out with Lou when he was working for Governing Magazine. Now we have a new variation on the Lou Jacobson theme. Lou Jacobson is a senior correspondent with PolitiFact, senior author of the Almanac of American Politics 2020. He previously handicapped gubernatorial races and electoral colleges for Governing Magazine. And he sent me a whole conga line of articles that he has been writing from everything from U.S. News and World Report. And there was something, was it the Cook Report?
Yes.
That was, mm-hmm. Okay, yep. Good. So, but the first one is the one that probably, we're going to start in sort of your latest to your earliest. So your latest one is no balloons, no party. Will virtual conventions change the campaign? So what you need to know, everyone, is I'm schmoozing with Lou before he gets on the air. And I go, so how many conventions have you been to? Because we're sort of compare notes. So you said you've only missed a handful.
I was going to be going to my 14th and 15th this year if they'd had in-person news coverage. Wow. Of course, they don't. So I have to wait until 2024 for that.
Assuming no pandemic.
Correct. But I have covered at least one convention every cycle going back to 1988.
Wow. So my first convention was 1992, and it was in New York. And I've gone to a couple of Republican ones, not when I was a candidate, but when I was a candidate, I went to Democratic ones. When I was not a candidate, I actually went to Republican ones. What does that tell you? Mm-hmm. But it was 1992, and I have to tell you a really fun story. So first of all, I left my pocketbook in a taxi cab. Okay, so here I am on my way to this big convention. I'm running for governor, and I leave everything. It has my credentials, my money, everything in a taxi cab. The amazing story of the 92 convention is that a businessman found my purse, picked it up, called Concord, New Hampshire, where my headquarters was, and says, "Is there a woman named Arnie Arneson that's running for governor in New Hampshire?" And they go, "Yes." He says, "I have her purse." And in New York City, in a taxi cab, this became a national story. I mean, people were so excited because it was such a good story about honesty and delivery. So he delivered that purse to me personally, which is just incredible. And then the other really fun piece is that I was running against the party chairman and the five-term congressman. And I was kind of the unknown mommy from the North Country. And this is the part that you will love, Lou. So we had hired a pollster a year before. And so she said to me, "All right, I'll go into the field." I said, "No." She said, "What did you hire me for?" I said, "I wanted to put you on retainer. And 1 year after I campaign, I want you to then go into the field to find out whether they heard me. I don't want you to tell me what they think. They need to know who I am and what I think." And she rolled her eyes and goes, Arnie, people don't do this. I said, I don't care. I'm not people. I'm Arnie. So literally, so we have a September primary. So I'm at the convention and I'm at a cocktail party. And all of a sudden, Ethel comes running into the room. And remember, I still have to win the primary before I get to the general. And she comes running into the room and she's screaming, it's a governor, it's a governor. And she had gone into the field a year after I started. And I was beating the two men, the five-term congressman and the party chairman by 2-1. And that's exactly what happened in the primary. So that was my first, my virgin convention, lose my purse and find out it's a governor. Well, not exactly, but anyway. So so we've had lots of experiences with primaries, both Republican and Democrats.
Can I just say that nobody cares, but my first primary, and I mean, my first convention and my only convention was 1972, when George McGovern, the nominee for president, came out to speak at 3 o'clock in the morning. And then he nominated a guy who had undergone shock therapy, who had to be replaced by Sergeant Shriver later. And this is history.
See, look at this. I mean, all three of us are long in the tooth. That's what that tells you. All right. So now that we've done this history down memory lane, let's go into your no balloons, no parties. Will virtual conventions change the campaign? And I'm thinking, I don't think the conventions are changing the campaign, but let's talk a little bit about it. So,
So it's sort of, it's basically new territory. We've never had a fully virtual convention. For us political types, that is a bigger deal probably than it is for the average voter. But still, it's different. There are a lot of things that go on at the conventions that, aren't obvious, but can have an effect on the course of the campaign. It's where the most energized people from each party get together, get psyched up for the fall, maybe take part in training, build sort of personal like relationships with people in their state and out of their state. We just don't know exactly how that's going to affect things. It's already kind of a weird campaign anyway, because of the pandemic and the shift to mail balloting. Probably in the end, it's probably going to be a bigger change because of mail balloting and the restrictions on people going out to canvass door to door, no big rallies because of social distancing. We just don't know how it's going to affect things. It's going to be just a very weird, weird campaign in 2020.
So let me, I don't disagree with you. And of course, this is all going to be visual. It's all going to be who does the best theatrics, who knows the best way of using social media and TV. So this is a production in a way that we can't even imagine. When you see the convention, on site where people are screaming and yelling, you're not actually looking at it for a sort of a television theatric. You kind of understand what you're seeing. Now, since there's going to be no crowds, there's going to be no bonding, it's all going to be on detail. It's all going to be on theatrics. It's all going to be how you play, how you tell your story, what kind of videos you include. In a way, this will have more meaning because people are going to look to see how you sort of have perfected the art of setting the stage. And that's what you're doing. What I think is interesting about this convention is that both players are known so well. So Donald Trump was known even before he went to his convention the first time. It was the art of the deal. And he got, $2 billion worth of free media anyway on CNN and MSNBC because he ran an unconventional campaign to have an unconventional, convention. And so this time, and he sees himself as this is his skill set.
Yeah.
It's going to be very interesting to see whether his skill set actually works at the Republican convention, because definitely, I think he thinks he's more skilled than he really is.
Yeah, I mean, usually if this were a more normal campaign year, you would think that Joe Biden has the most to lose, being the out-of-power party, taking on an incumbent. Usually the out-of-power party doesn't have anybody who's as well-known as the incumbent. So they really need to use and he doesn't have the podium that the president does, who can get on TV pretty much anytime they want. The Democratic Democratic nominee in this case is the out of power candidate, But it's really Trump who thrives by the sort of in-person kind of playing to the room, exactly, having that personal relationship with the audience. And so not having the convention with the balloons dropping and the signs waving and so forth, it's probably a bigger deal for Trump than it is for Biden, even though he's the challenger.
Biden. Well, and to a large extent, because we know Biden so well, and we know his relationship with Barack Obama and the first night Michelle Obama, it's going to feel like it's the 12th year.
Yeah. Yeah. We've had basically 3.5 years now of the Trump presidency, which has been kind of chaotic for various reasons. A lot of stress for like a lot of Americans, especially those who are not fans of Trump. Maybe Joe Biden's best approach is just having a very sort of calm, sedate contrast with the sort of, hyperbolic rhetoric and so forth that we've seen from Trump. If Biden can kind of portray a very calming demeanor and sort of getting back to normalcy, that is probably what I see as his best approach.
So one of the things I was talking to a friend about, they almost don't see the Trump presidency as a presidency. They see it as a hiccup.
A hiccup.
Uh-huh. Like it's a mistake, and to a large extent, what I think that what Joe is going to try to do is remind people how we perceive the presidency, what we expect of a president, how the president is supposed to behave. And I think in a lot of ways, so that Trump is an anomaly and Trump really isn't a president. It's almost like you don't even need to, I hear Republicans all the time, especially the Lincoln Project, they never call him President Trump. They call him Mr. Trump. I mean, the term Mr. Trump is used over and over again because they are not acknowledging the fact that he was elected. They're not acknowledging the fact that he does have that bully pulpit because they keep calling him Mr. Trump. And I think what's also interesting for Biden, and you sort of see it with Kasich appearing on the first night in between Bernie Sanders and Michelle Obama. I keep describing it as the three faces of Eve, But it's like, which flavor do you want? Do you want the conservative? Do you want the conservative Democrat? Do you the moderate Republican? Or do you want the Democratic Socialist? We got all three, Whatever flavor you want, we're there for you, It's almost hilarious, You almost wish they had an ice cream associated with them. And we could all sort of like be eating ice cream at the same time.
It sort of reminds me of the 1988 Democratic Convention when they had three keynoters. It was Zell Miller, Governor Ann Richards of Texas, and I think maybe Bill Clinton was the third one. Three very different sort of personalities.
And didn't Zell Miller go back to being like a good Republican or whatever he was? Zell was a disappointment.
He was a lifelong Democrat and then became a Republican when party became...
Exactly. Ken, you wanted to weigh in?
Yes.
Yeah, I was just going to follow up on what Lou was saying earlier about Biden's campaign. I don't know how exactly he put it, but the way I would put it is that Biden has been advantaged so far by basically staying in his basement and staying out of the limelight, saying nothing. And that does two things. One, it leaves it to Trump to make a fool of himself and announce policies and other announcements that people can tear Trump up and make him the issue. But it also is frustrating the heck out of Trump because he has nothing to go after Biden with.
Nothing to punch.
And to the extent that Biden continues that throughout the campaign, it's like punching at a ghostly punching bag. There's nothing there for Trump to go after. And all Trump can do is foam at the mouth.
Well,
But there is, a Facebook ad or a series of Facebook ads in which the Trump campaign tried to portray as like Joe Biden alone in his basement. But they actually had to manipulate the images by like darkening out anything surrounding him and like removing something from his hands through Photoshop, because there literally isn't enough art that they could use that exists of Joe Biden that they had to create one that fit their narrative. So it's kind of amazing. Biden has been so risk averse and it makes sense because he is, according to the polls, he is several points ahead. And so you do want to have a risk-averse campaign if that's your situation. One of the weird things I think we'll probably see at the convention is just how these speeches are going to go over without the audience, as you were saying. Right. I mean, what I kind of compare it to are some of the late night shows. If you've seen them, Seth Meyers and Stephen Colbert, you know, sitting in their attics or whatever. And you're used to hearing people in the audience laugh at their jokes, but they're not. And like, it sort of changes the experience of what it's like to hear jokes when you don't have that sort of, you know, communal experience. And I wonder how that's going to play out, if that's going to affect how people perceive these candidates when they're not standing there with a supportive audience around them.
Well, that's why they should all have been radio talk show hosts. Because we're always talking into the wind, you know. Right. We never see anyone. We don't even know if anyone's listening to us, and we're carrying on a marvelous conversation. It was like, I'm sure the feedback is incredible. Trust me. So, but before we kind of leave this, I will tell you why I think there'll be a high curiosity level on the part of the public, and I think this will get pretty high ratings. And the reason is that you're absolutely right. Biden has done nothing but really put a mirror up and hasn't said a word. Every time Trump looks to punch, he has a mirror, and the mirror is of Donald. It's not, I mean, so Joe gets to hide behind the mirror. Well, in a lot of ways, these next couple of days, he's not gonna be able to hide behind a mirror, but in a way he still is, because he's gonna have all these other people talking, not him. So even for the 4 days, it's going to be less Biden than Biden. You know, everyone will be talking about it. But I think a lot of people are kind of curious, because they don't know who Biden is for the purposes of policy, because he's been so wallpaperish, is what I describe it, that I'm going to tune in to see what he actually says about policy. I mean, I feel a sense of a lack of satisfaction as to what I actually know he will do. I know he won't be Donald, but I'm trying to figure what's Joe. And that's really what the real question is. The only difference, I think, between the two is I think you are going to see a level of diversity that it's going to blow your mind. You're going to not know that there were that many, you know, not only African-Americans and Indians and Hispanics. And I mean, it's going to be this quilt of color and people and accents. And it's just in that way, just visually, when you look at that versus what's going to be, I don't know what Donald Trump is going to do. He's going to have to put uniforms on them. He's going to have to like rent stuff from the Rockettes, because otherwise it's going to be old white men who are going to be there, and he may have to import some people. But just the visual makeup of who talks is going to be absolutely fascinating, because it speaks volumes about who we are today. And what Donald Trump is going to be able to pull out is not going to look like us.
Yeah.
Amazing.
You know, I would say my closing thought on the impact of the conventions is that more than other campaigns in the past, there is a real, like the vote or the feelings on especially Trump is pretty settled. Either you love him or you hate him. There's not a lot of persuadable voters out there. And so I'm not sure in the end that the change of the convention format is going to make much of a difference, because I can't imagine that there's a huge number of people out there in the country who are kind of undecided at this point. And if they are, would they tune into a 4-day extravaganza to kind of settle that?
I think the only people that are undecided are those that are afraid of living or dying. I mean, when you're beginning to see how even Republicans are beginning to embrace the mask, how you're beginning to see how Republicans, I mean, they want to live. And they're beginning to realize that Donald Trump not only doesn't tell them the truth, but gives them sort of misinformation about the science, is telling them about numbers that completely fly in the face of what they're actually seeing. So it's going to be really interesting. What is persuadable is life or death, not Republican or Democrat. And because his prescription basically makes them vulnerable, and possibly, you know, either if they're not dying, they're going to have some permanent condition for life. I mean, that's why all the sports teams are now beginning to rethink whether they're actually going to be playing sports in the fall. Right. And it's not because they think they couldn't survive COVID. It's because, what happens if I have a permanent heart condition? I'll never play football again. What if I have a permanent lung condition? I'll never play baseball again. It's not freaking worth it. Well, if they've figured it out, then guess what? I think you're going to see the American people. And isn't it interesting? It's not going to be about Republican or Democrat. It's going to be more about life or death or the quality of your living.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening with COVID. It's going to be amazing. So you also wrote some other stories, and I wanted to talk a little bit more about those. And that is, what's going to happen with legislatures around the country? One of the things I found fascinating was that, you know, a decade ago, the Republicans were brilliant and the Democrats were asleep at the switch. The Republicans figured out that they had to control every legislature possible, that that was more important than anything else. We're always focused on presidents. They think, we need to focus on the legislature, especially during the time of a census and what happens with redistricting. So tell me what you are seeing, because you're seeing a shift when it comes to what's happening with legislatures.
Yeah, so absolutely. 2010, the Democrats, you said it exactly right, were totally asleep at the switch. It was, you know, going to be a hard year anyway, because it was the first midterm after Obama won, but they got decimated. Some of those chambers were in places where they're never going to come back again, and it was just a matter of time. A couple of southern chambers where Democrats have been in charge for generations, and then it switched, and then they're like gone forever. But there are a lot of them that were in more kind of swingy states, Pennsylvania,
Michigan.
Wisconsin, Michigan, where the line drawing in 2010 really helped the GOP preserve in fairly competitive states, pretty solid majorities in the legislature. Now the timing is very beneficial for the Democrats. If things go as they seem to be going in the polls, the Democrats should be able to gain a bunch of chambers back. In the most recent handicapping I did, I shifted, I believe it was eight chambers in the Democratic direction, including North Carolina, Georgia, and
maybe
Ohio,
Texas. And maybe Texas. We cover Texas every single week. We hang out with Scott Braddock, who's the head of the Quorum Report, and we have learned so much. And I'm telling you, they are panicking. They'll keep the Senate in Texas, but they may lose the House of Representatives. And the Democrats are smelling it.
And that's the football they need.
That's the football.
To affect redistricting. Yeah.
Exactly right. So I'm just telling you, even Texas. I mean, it may be that Trump wins by a very thin margin, but in the House, you might actually see some significant changes. And I just want to make a comment here. We go back to 2010 because I'm, you know, the political scientist in the family, and we go back to 2010, and you realize that the Democrats did not show up, and the Republicans just did this amazing job of partisan gerrymandering and racial gerrymandering, whatever it is, they figured out exactly how to do it. So with the least number of people, they could get the most number of seats.
Yeah.
So the beauty of what's going to happen in this next election is that while we're still talking about these partisan gerrymandered districts for state legislatures, by the end of a decade, they're less effective. So how you gerrymander in 2010 doesn't look so good in 2020 because people die, people move, there are so many things. So this is the weakest time for you to actually hold on to your seat. That's the benefit for Democrats. Not only do they have a strong number with Joe Biden, but they also have the weakest gerrymandering because it's been a decade and those seats don't hold as well a decade later. They're much
weaker. It definitely varies state by state, like in Wisconsin. That's the one kind of presidential battleground state where the Democrats seem to be pretty good spot, where I just don't see them taking over the chamber this year. Either of the chambers. That could change between now and Election Day, but that was a pretty solid GOP line drawing in 2010. Other ones, Pennsylvania, the Democrats actually challenged in court, and there's a mid-decade redistricting. But even the original 2010 in Pennsylvania, in terms of the congressional seats, started to fracture, about halfway through the decade, and it's accelerated by that redrawing.
Right.
So whereas in some states you may have a situation where a gerrymander was unchanged through the entire 10 years, and then the chambers switch in 2020 and the other party redraws the lines with a big effect. In some states, some of that shift has already taken place under the old lines. And so there won't be as dramatic a shift in 2020. It's just sort of a mixed bag.
I know. It's going to be, but again, the fact that you're seeing eight chambers changing, and I just want people to know those eight chambers are changing from Republican to Democrat. And that gave me hope. But I also want, I posted on my Facebook page, everyone, and I'll post it all also on the Attitudes Facebook page, because you go state by state by state, and you sort of tell people what's happening in their state. So you can look at this, whether you're in Michigan, because I have listeners in Michigan and Texas, you can begin to look at the analysis as you're doing it. And the analysis of New Hampshire got me a little bit nervous. I'm just telling you right now that, you know, you said we'll keep the House, but we might lose the Senate. So I said, warning. Thank you so much, honey bun.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, exactly. So Lou Jacobson, thank you so much. I'm so glad that I got to meet you on Governing Magazine. Yes. I'm so glad you're still writing. U.S. News and World Report is very lucky to have you, and so is the Cook Report. We'll be talking because things are going to be shifting between now and November anyway. So stay healthy and keep writing. All right, Jeff.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. We're going to take a break and be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1922. That was the day 1,300 workers from four railroad brotherhoods walked off the job in Joliet, Illinois, near Chicago. The walkout threatened to paralyze freight service for steel mills in nearby Gary and other regional industries. 400,000 railroad shopmen had been on strike across the country for nearly 7 weeks. Newspaper headlines that day warned a general strike of 2 million trademen loomed on the horizon. Brotherhood leaders promised sympathy strikes in response to threats made against their members by troops on duty at railroad centers and yards. There were also real concerns about the health and safety of trainmen, given rolling stock was no longer being maintained. In Joliet, workers stayed away under threats from troops. Additionally, Illinois Central trainmen faced threats from striking miners throughout Kentucky and Illinois who warned, "Stop transporting non-union coal or suffer the consequences." Resentment had been building up against state guard troops stationed in Illinois yards. Earlier in the week, striking shopmen had engaged in a fatal confrontation with Joliet sheriffs that left a striker and a railroad detective dead and scores injured. Riot orders were called when authorities sought to arrest striking shopmen who had stormed the home of a scab. Brotherhood workers refused to return to work unless the troops were removed. Warren Stone, president of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, stated, quote, "We are not going to have our men shot up or beaten up or threatened by armed guards at railroad shops and yards. When the men cannot go to work without having irresponsible armed guards endangering their lives, they may go home and stay there. There will be 100 more cases soon if conditions are not changed." Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I saw her today at the reception. A glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, well, you might find. Singing words gonna bend our frustration. If we don't, we're gonna blow a 50-amp fuse. Sing it to me. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You just might find you get what you need. Oh, baby, yeah.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. you know where I always go. I go to theconversation.com. I love that site. I've made good friends from that site. PhDs from around the country and professors and people that I wish I had known 20 years ago. So here was the article that led me to our next guest. Yes, most workers can collect more in coronavirus unemployment than they earn. But that doesn't mean Congress should cut the $600 supplement. And of course, what we know is Donald Trump has now come up with this like crazy idea of $400 because he's going to do it by executive order. But then he's going to ask the states to come up with 25%. Of course, the states don't have a pot to you know what in. So they're not going to come up with the extra 25%. So we are still in an incredible limbo state. Let me welcome to the program now, David. Is it Salkever. David Salkever received his PhD in economics from Harvard University. He spent 33 years as a faculty member in the schools of public health and of arts and sciences at Johns Hopkins, 15 years as a professor in the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. He currently holds the title of professor emeritus. One of the things I really liked is you were a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research for 34 years. Whoa, did they give you a gold watch? That's a long time. So welcome to the program, and I'm so appreciative not only of your history, because this is really where you know where to look, David. So everybody's talking, but they're talking through their hat. They're talking with what they think they know, but you know even where to look. So not only do I welcome you to the program, but talk to us how you did your analysis, because I want people to hear this, because you slice this in really interesting ways, and I think it's really important for people to understand why this isn't just a story about, you know, the pandemic, about unemployment, about people maybe even getting more than they earn. It's about why this is necessary now, perhaps even more than ever.
Right. So I took the approach that I wanted to look at the whole population, the data, recent data from the U.S. Census current population survey that just became available about a month or so ago, provided a good opportunity to delve into this. And at the same time, there's been a bunch of papers that have just started to appear in various economic conferences and working papers, all of which I think are pointing pretty much in the same direction, that is the opposite direction from the one that you hear the rhetoric going, especially on the Republican side of the aisle right now, in terms of arguing against the supplemental $600 benefit per right. week. So that's essentially the impetus for looking into this.
So now defend what you said, because I loved your defense, because you really did look at it in a way that even acknowledged, if some people are making more, that you have to look beyond just that statement.
Absolutely. Well, there are a couple reasons. Number one, there's some things that get left out, importantly, when you simply look at dollars of wages and you ignore lots of other features of you're having a job that may be very attractive to people, such as health insurance, for example, and other kinds of benefits that employers provide, which also, by the way, are tax-free. So they're actually, on a dollar-per-dollar basis, worth more than $1 of before-tax earnings. So I think that was important. And the other thing that was important is that people seem to assume that if you're on unemployment, you're sort of a free agent in terms of whether you want to sit around and do nothing, or whether there's any sort of requirements you have to meet. Well, it turns out that it varies from state to state, but there are requirements. Yes. You are expected to look for a job.
Right.
You can't just sit home and do nothing and watch TV. There's also an expectation that if you receive what is regarded by the unemployment insurance folks as a satisfactory job offer, that you're expected to take it.
Exactly.
And if you refuse, then you can lose your unemployment insurance benefit. So the story that people are all sitting around home now that they've gotten more than their money wages doing nothing because that's all they want to do, and they're perfectly happy to do this for as long as possible, I think is quite misleading. And it turns out, of course, that the evidence supports the view that the supposed disincentive effects really aren't there.
So let me just say a couple of things. So one of the things I did was I decided to look at how much people get from unemployment in the 50 states. Mm-hmm. And the range is shocking. Let me repeat. The range is shocking. It can be as low as the highest could be in like Mississippi or something like $230. $230 a week. That's the highest, not the lowest, the highest. I wonder how low they can go. I didn't even look at the low, but that's the highest. And then you go to places like Massachusetts where you could get as much as $850 a week.
Correct.
But that's the highest, the highest. Yep. My state's like around 420, 430. We're like half of Massachusetts. So people don't know. It's not a cookie cutter approach. Every state is different on how much you're going to actually get from just generic unemployment. And they have no clue. They have no clue. So that was important. Your point about health insurance is really important, David. But let me just say something else. So I've been talking to a lot of friends who are unemployed because they used to work in the restaurant industry. Now, the restaurant industry, even if they're going to call people back, aren't calling everyone back because they don't need them. You know, if they call three people back when they had maybe a staff of 30, it's because they're doing, you know, doing takeouts. That's all they're doing.
Yeah.
So someone said to me, but you don't know, Arnie, why that $600 is crucial. She said, when I worked at the restaurant, they fed me. So I didn't need that meal. Mm-hmm. She said, when I worked at the restaurant at the end of the shift, if it was the end of the night, if there was leftover food, I took it home to my family. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things are a supplement to income that nobody ever figures out. And then she said something even more sort of shocking. And she said, where I live, my kid would get, you know, breakfast and lunch at school. My kid's not in school. And they haven't figured out how to supplement his food intake. Mm-hmm. So now where historically the school would be feeding him, she's now feeding him with less money and nothing being taken home from the restaurant. I mean, we need to give people a sense of what people's lives are like. They don't have a clue, David.
Yeah, yeah. And another factor, I think, is that people don't just think about the next 2 weeks or the next month. They do think about the future. Yeah. And if you have a steady job that seems to be going along and is pretty stable, and you have a choice between doing that or somehow going on unemployment with uncertain expectations as to what kind of new job you're going to get and when you're going to get a job back, that uncertainty is not very attractive.
It isn't attractive. And also remind everyone, you know what I can't believe, David, and you mentioned this in your article, how come Walmart and Kmart and Target and all those, how come they aren't berserk about losing that $600? Because you and I both know that every dime that comes in that unemployment check is going right out. It's going out in gas. It's going out in food. It's going out to Walmart. It's going out to Target. And if anything is going to harm the economy, we're going to start feeling it at the end of August. Because if those checks completely disappear and they don't get reinstated, you are going to see an incredible decrease in economic activity.
Yeah, I think it may start showing up even sooner. In fact, there was just a new paper that came out just this morning I saw.
I'm so glad, David, you're looking.
Which basically said that even if you go down from 600 supplement per week to 400, that the result will be that economic activity will decline by about 12%.
Oh my God.
This was a study done based in the state of Illinois, but methods that would apply elsewhere. So,
Send me that study.
Sure.
And the other thing you did was there's an interesting map at the conversation, and the map is of the 50 states. Mm-hmm. And you describe and explain to my audience exactly what that map shows, because what is interesting to me is the states that are going to be so hurt by the $600. Some states, you know, in New Hampshire, we're a rich state. We're the seventh richest state in the nation. So the impact of the loss of the 600 is not quite as devastating as it's going to be in places like Texas, which saw a significant boost, or maybe even, you know, some Mississippi, they saw a significant boost. This $600 is a huge influx of money at a time they desperately need it.
Right, Right. Yeah. I think if I remember correctly, New Mexico might have been the highest in the sense that 77% of the people who were working in the private sector in New Mexico, in terms of what they would be eligible for with, for unemployment benefits, would actually have been eligible for more in benefits than they were taking home just in money wages. And that was the tops.
Yeah.
Whereas Washington, D.C., which has, you know, lots of lobbyists and fairly well-paid folks, the figure was more like around 30% or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah,
I don't remember the exact number.
It's a fascinating map, and I want to make sure that people take a look at the map and look at their state and see what the difference is, and really what that speaks to. I mean, what this speaks to is how poor people are being paid. That's
oh, yes.
what the, yep. this is because yep. what I reminded everyone is, you know what the $600 equals? $15 an hour. That's mm-hmm. what $600 is. It's $15 an hour. And when you look at what you get, you know, with your just your unemployment, your straight unemployment, and it might be like 130 a week, you know, 130 a week, what does that buy you? It buys you nothing. It doesn't pay yeah. rent, doesn't pay food, doesn't do anything. Because remember, these people probably have children and responsibilities. So again, yeah. that's part of the issue. So David, as we look at this, I hope they reinstate the 600, but what are we going to do? Because this really is a story, not only of the gap between rich and poor, where you've seen the rich just, I mean, we've created more billionaires in the last 4 months during a pandemic. We've seen the billionaires, you know, basically rake in $500 billion. We saw Warren Buffett, I think saw his wealth increase by 86%.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, he I'm a, looking at this.
Yeah, a good really, quarter.
It was a good, you saw the good quarter.
Yeah,
it was a good
yeah.
quarter. And so as we look at this and then you look at who's being hurt, why would anyone even think twice about cutting the $600 check?
Yeah, well, I think number one, a lot of people aren't aware of what a big impact it's making.
Yes.
You know, and just how much of a boost it's giving to the economy. And I'm afraid we're probably going to find out if they don't replace it pretty soon.
Yeah.
Also, I think we tend to get a lot of people tend to get a false sense of how well the economy is doing because every day we hear about the stock market.
Yeah, exactly.
And every day the stock market does pretty well
right.
thanks to the fact that there's something, what is it, like $500 billion that is going into super low-cost loans from the Fed to large corporations.
Mm-hmm.
So they've really been helped out quite a bit by the government during this period. But the folks who were supporting the 70% of the economy that's consumers, you know, that's consumption, they're not doing very well. And they're going to have, you know, more trouble ahead, especially if this supplement gets cut.
So David, I have a question about what happens with unemployment. So my boss releases me, so I can get pink slipped. But if my boss calls me back, do I have to say yes? If I'm concerned about COVID, for example, and I'm in a place where there isn't enough social distancing, there's bad ventilation, I'm glad my boss let me go, but now my boss is calling me back. Are you obligated to say yes? And if you don't say yes to returning to work, do you lose your unemployment benefits?
My understanding is that it depends on the state.
Okay.
That it really depends on how states enforce the general rule that a suitable offer of employment
right.
cannot be refused or else you lose your benefits.
So now, what about the other thing is, that you could be offered a suitable replacement.
Right.
But what is suitable if you're told now that you need to homeschool because school is not open mm-hmm. and you have two children and therefore where you could go to work because your children would be in school, now it's a challenge to go to work because your children are now home and they need to be schooled and there is no daycare and there is no, you know, there is no one to care for the kid. Is there an exception where you're saying, well, it's suitable, but it's not suitable because what do I do with my children? Because if I don't care for my children and I don't make sure that they, you know, are doing their lessons, Health and Human Services could come in and basically take my kids away because I'm a bad parent. I mean, think about the choices you have.
Yeah.
If you're not in home and these kids are there, are latchkey without a parent, you know, technically Health and Human Services could say, you're not showing, you know, that you're acting in good stead as a parent. Therefore, I need to take your kids away. But you're saying, but I have to go back for my job, because if I don't go back for my job, I lose my benefits and I don't get the income. Yeah. Think of the dilemma, David.
Oh, yeah. I am not aware that there is any general exception that allows you to, you know, to deal with that problem. I suspect, for example, that a lot of the folks who worked in the, who've been working in the meatpacking industry, yes, in the Midwest and elsewhere, have basically been facing that situation pretty frequently.
Exactly.
And that's generally the rule, Arnie. In, you know, the standard rule is that if you get offered a job, you have to go, and it's no excuse whether you have childcare issues. I mean, think about this. Say you're a parent of young children who don't go to school, and you don't have daycare that you can afford. They don't care. Too bad. You may get welfare or TANF now, but you're not going to get unemployment.
Well, but let me just say something. So, David, this is where this is. So you talked about the fact that they're already seeing an effect of the economy with the loss of the 600.
Right.
What we also know is we're about to go back to school. Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is going to also add another wrinkle to the conversation of unemployment benefits, because one of the things that I'm recognizing, my school in Concord, New Hampshire, has decided all remote. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, I'm watching parents like grieving. It's not that they don't love their children. It's not that they don't want to take care of them. Yes, they're terrified about COVID-19. They don't know what to do. They don't know, because they're not in the luxury job of being able to work at home. Mm-hmm. They have a job where they have to work. Now the question is, how do they go back to work? Because now they've just been told by the school, it's going to be all remote. And we might think, well, what's a 15-year-old remote? I mean, they're babysitters. They're 15. No. Right. If you're not home watching your 15-year-old, are you sure they're going to school? I'm not so sure. So it's going to be really interesting, because all these unemployment questions are now going to actually be enhanced by the whole challenge of school.
Yes, and that really gets to the issue of what other kinds of arrangements could be made. You know, how, even if you were getting the $600 supplement, you know, for unemployment, it's not that easy to find, you know, ways to somehow make it possible so that you could have the opportunity alternatively to go back and go to work. I think Biden's suggestions about major support for childcare services is definitely a step in the right direction, and it's a big problem.
So before I let you go, we were talking about how this has really been sort of keeping the economy propped up. You know, we're all focusing on the stock market, but the stock market is not the economy. And, you know, very few people actually really play in the stock market, except for maybe the top 10 or 1%. So we know that the $600 has been an infusion that have kept people in their homes. It's kept people paying rent. And now we've seen, you know, the end of eviction, for preventing people from getting evicted. And now we know the $600 has happened simultaneously, and we're going back to school simultaneously, and we're heading into the fall where we're talking about a double bump from the COVID-19. I mean, we're talking about a quafecta of failure, not just a trifecta, but whatever it is. How come the business community hasn't spoken up as one? Because they know it too. I mean, you don't have to be going to Tuck Business School. I don't have to be at Harvard Business School. I do the math. And the math says that they need the 600, not just the people that are getting the 600. And what is just shocking to me is to hear how quiet they are. Where is the Chamber of Commerce? Where is the business community? If anyone should be beating the drum, it should be them. Poor people, unemployed people, they don't have a drum to beat, but they do, and they have access to power. How come they're not using it?
I can't answer that question. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and I'm just amazed that the administration, thinking that their best shot for, you know, for staying in power is to revive the economy, that even they aren't jumping at the chance to do something here, because it's going to be grim. It's going to be grim, and I think all the business folks know it. The only major businesses that are not perhaps as concerned that you already mentioned are the folks like the Amazons, the tech companies, the small number of companies that are doing very well. The top 40, 50 companies in the Standard & Poor's are doing great, and they may not say very much, but there are a whole lot of other businesses that are going to be hurt in a major way. And of course, small businesses are having a terrible time.
Yeah. So I think that's what's going to be so interesting. We were just talking about the conventions that are about to happen. And I hope that Joe Biden, I hope he does a math problem for the American people. I want him to explain this math. I don't want people to think that you are cutting a check for someone to sit home and eat bonbons. I want him to explain that this check is actually crucial to the economy, that it's keeping us afloat. It's keeping people employed. The $600, everyone, is keeping other people employed. I mean, nobody's even made that argument, David. You know, it's not like I'm spending $600 on something that doesn't actually go to another worker. I mean, oy vey. And yeah. every governor knows that if you don't have the $600, you're not paying your property taxes. And every governor knows that if you're not getting the $600, you're not paying your sales taxes. I mean, it's just, and so what I would love Biden to do, or someone, maybe not Biden, maybe Elizabeth Warren, is to actually do a math class. And do a math class for the American people and take the information from your article, David, put up the map for everyone to see, get some of those articles like the Yale study and the study that just came out of Illinois, and say, I'm going to teach a class today. And this is the class about what happens during a pandemic when we have over 10% unemployment. And this is why we need to do this. And what they are doing is they're showing you they never passed math.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it has to do with what actually gets into the media. Yes. And the fact that, for example, like this Illinois thing basically just came out today and said that if the supplements go away totally, we're going to have about a 30% decline in economic activity, you know, which
it's shocking. It's I hold my heart because I can't quite believe that those kinds of stories are coming out. Now the question is, how do we fertilize them and make sure that everybody hears them? And that's another reason why I'm hoping during this convention, when we may get some more eyeballs and people may be focused, I want to give them ammunition. I want them to have this math. I want them to see your piece. Absolutely. And I want them to see the Illinois piece. So again, everyone, I'm going to recommend that you go to theconversation.com, my absolute favorite site on the planet. It's in countries all over the world. They get faculty and PhDs to write about their area of expertise. And that's what I've always loved, David, is you teach classes, but I don't always get to access you because I'm not sitting in that class. But what theconversation.com does is it gives me access to a David. So I really appreciate it. The title of his piece, yes, most workers can collect more in coronavirus unemployment than they earn, but that doesn't mean Congress should cut the $600 supplement. Thank you for being my math teacher.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
And, it's a pleasure.
I think it's saying something that needs to be said.
It does. David Salk, pronounce your last name again.
Salkiever.
Salkiever. David Salkiever, you're back on again. I promise you, you're coming back. All right. Thank you so much. Ciao.
My pleasure.
All right. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll schmooze tomorrow.